I think we'll revise the schedule I had in mind initially anyway. And we'll ask you to turn in your papers on lesson two for today. And I will record that you've done the work and get them again into your hands tomorrow, and you'll be able to start in on that material. What we'll do is make a shift with regard to the original plans concerning lesson three. That will be due on Thursday the 26th. Now, I've just made that shift, so I'm going to have to make other changes accordingly. So as soon as I work that out, and that won't take long, I'll announce some other dates for Brown and others are interested in some other dates. So lesson three is due on Thursday the 26th. We'll have three sessions for it. And so I would particularly pay attention to analysis and give more time to analysis. I think it would be best to put your main time on chapter three, which involves questions one and two under analysis. I will do some work on four, but focus on three. And in terms of synthesis, I would focus on number one. If you have time to do something with number two with regard to Paul's use of the Old Testament, that would be helpful. But I would focus attention on number one. Now, as soon as we get into the analysis of the parts, which of course is what we're beginning to do at lesson two, we'll be talking more about the process of analysis, which I hope will further your understanding of what's entailed in these lessons that have to do with study of the parts.
Dr. Kennedy, did you want to do more than chapter two, the main relation?
No, I would stick to the same type of the survey and spend the extra time in the analysis. And perhaps on number two of the synthesis analysis. I had originally indicated that if we had just the two sessions, we would omit number two of the synthesis. But I would have to give a little time to that. Mainly analysis. Other questions, comments? Let me just urge you then to check your boxes tomorrow before you come to class. So that you'll have a paper to put
in that
call. I'd like to do that tomorrow, if I may. You can begin with your survey for tomorrow on this passage, and we'll talk about analysis tomorrow. I'd like to get to the book as a whole before we spend very much of our time. And I think that will take most of our time, if not all the day, so we'll do that tomorrow. Okay? All right. We've indicated on the basis of what we have on the first page of the syllabus that there are three main concerns that we have with regard to studying books as whole. The one is to work on this matter of surveying or previewing books as whole. That's A under method one on page one. The second is to interpret individual parts in light of the whole. And we'll be working with that as we move to the parts. That includes detailed analysis of the parts, which we'll be talking about tomorrow. And then through this whole matter of synthesis that we'll talk about before we ask you to synthesize relations as we do in lesson five. And we've been working now on the first of these, a survey or preview of the whole, and I have worked with three of the four main areas in that. One has to do with getting at material, both specific and general. The latter is not very much of a problem in the area of these epistles because they are in all regards, ideological in terms of the basic materials. The second has to do with structure, getting at the main structural units, and then how they're tied together, the two primary laws, and the materials with which they're used. And then the third has to do with asking, interpret structural questions about each of the laws, and the materials with which the laws are used. Now, what we'll do is hold off the discussion of strategic areas, the fourth of these, until we actually do it with Galatians. So we're combining our study of Galatians with the discussion of strategic areas and try to clarify what that involves. So let's begin with this matter of materials first. We haven't tried to put chapter titles on the board, so let me simply ask you, do you have any questions about this matter of giving chapter titles to materials like this? What difficulties do you have, if any? Is there any way we can help to clarify that procedure? This is the In the meantime, we'll discuss that, and otherwise we'll go on to other things that are more complicated. But let's see if you have any questions along that line. Any questions about chapter titles here? Paul? I would work with the chapters as they are given you in the RSV text tentatively, on the basis that later on you can work with breaking them down into what perhaps are more accurate units of thought and expression. But if you try to do that now, you'll get into further steps of the study process. You'll get into the structure of individual units and various things of that sort, so that really gets you farther than you ought to go at this stage, and causes you to lose focus. So I would work tentatively with chapter units at this stage.
Yeah. In doing a chapter like that, if you do have the two things, I mean, would you try to take the stronger of the two of them, or try to combine them somewhere? I guess that's what I would call them, two chapters.
Give an example of what you have in mind.
I remember dealing with them, I can't remember what I was going to do. It seems like chapter two was that way, a little bit ahead too. Two answers is like Paul's saying, you know, he's talking about one thing in one part of the chapter, and the other part he's talking about justification of faith and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they usually try to take the stronger of the two, so as far as just coming up with a chapter title.
Well, in material like that, where you can't find a comprehensive title that covers everything, you have diverse elements in the unit. What I would try to do is to pick up an important element. I wouldn't try to make a judgment as to which is most important, because that sometimes launches you into interpretation to material. But an important element, and then by association, try to connect it with other elements so that you're able to recall the other elements by the use of the chapter title. So, for example, in chapter 2, one might call that material the right hand of fellowship, which focuses on what happened in Jerusalem. But then, by contrast, what happened in Antioch, say, and you realize that there is this contrast. That association has to do with relationships there. Now, you can associate in other ways as well, but relationships very often help you to associate things. Or in chapter 1, where you have a number of elements, you might call that a different gospel, focusing on the first part of it, and of course his autobiographical statements indicate the two kinds of gospels that one could hold, and of course he says the gospel that I hold, because of the reasons of how I got it, etc., is the true gospel, and this other is a different gospel. So that's the kind of thing I tend to do. In other words, what you need to do, reading in this case, most often, is to use an associative title or a suggestive title as over against a comprehensive title. As I say, if you can get a comprehensive title which fulfills the other requirements for Christ, such as being relatively unique, and justification by faith wouldn't be relatively unique, because we talked about that also, but talked about that in chapter 3, etc. So as long as it meets the other criteria, well, a comprehensive title is fine. But very often you have to get this kind of title, and then by association, as the characteristic indicates, try to connect it with other elements in the chapter so as to recall those other elements to your mind. Does that respond to your question?
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions on this matter of chapter title? As I said, the matter of general material is not really an issue because of the similarity of these books to each other. But let me ask, just in case you have any questions, that might be applicable for other books. Are you clear on what we mean by giving your general impression about the dominant focal material in the book as a whole? Are you clear as to the kind of thing you're looking for in doing that? No questions on that? You may recall we indicated that you have several kinds of basic materials, general materials, your biographical materials, sparse materials, etc. So what you ought to do after you've named the chapters, specific material, look back at the material overall and ask in terms of general impression what is the focal kind of material here that predominates the book as a whole. And in this case, it's ideological. He's trying to set forth certain things. Now, he uses the didactical element, but that's subordinate, by way of supporting this polemical concept that will come to in just a moment when we look at the structure of the book further.
One of the things that maybe I'm picking up on an answer away, or maybe I'm missing altogether, it seems like that the title that you're putting on the epistle is radically different from the title that you put on the gospel. Is that because of the material being so different? I mean, prescript really doesn't seem to be very descriptive. I mean,
That's not a title for chapter one.
Okay, so you haven't done
any... No, these are not titles for chapters here. This moves to the structure.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
You're really getting that confused.
I gave you a title for chapter one, a different gospel, which you find in 1, 6, and 9, which relates to this. Relates to other materials in 6. And then, you know, in 1, and 7 follows. Or 10 follows, if you put it. There you go. But that would be a chapter title.
Okay, so we need to have, a title type breakdown, and a structural breakdown, and then a law breakdown. Okay. Structural law breakdown.
Yeah, but a law that relates to structure. And one way of doing this, and I have done it up here just to save time, is to use this slanted version here for your chapter title. Then under it, through this kind of thing, for example, in terms of your major divisions here, you know what we're doing. I'll take this in terms of the dictionary structure. You have a prescript, you have a body, and then you have a postscript here. You can further break that down here in this way. So that's the way you can diagram this kind of thing if you want to put the chapter titles on the diagram as well.
That's helpful.
Okay. Now, there are two elements, unless you have questions on materials, there are two elements that we look for and try to accomplish in looking for structure, and both involve the law of structure that we talked about, the law of relationship. One is to find what the main structural units are, and we're looking primarily for the largest unit, namely divisions, but then if you can find them, either all to indicate subunits, sections, subsections, where you move down the scale. And that really means what groupings of materials are formed by relationships, which bind these materials to each other more closely than they're bound to what's around them. That means, we just move up to the larger unit here, this way. That's what we're looking for when we look for groupings or units. That's done by laws of relationship, especially recurrence, although others are used. And then the second thing you want to do is to find what are the primary laws that tie all of these units together into the book as a whole, and specific materials which they use, and then those are the aspects that on which you focus your questions, the structural questions. So let's move now beyond materials to structure, and we've indicated to you what may be seen as the most major structural units beyond the epistolary structure, which is prescript, body, and postscript. And by the way, prescript always involves what relationship?
Preparation
and real admission. The prescript prepares you for understanding the epistle, and usually by doing at least three things, sometimes more, but at least three things, identifying who the writer is. You know, if you were to lock this off, 1 to 5, and start in on 6, you wouldn't know how to understand the materials in terms of the writer. Now, who's talking here? That's a matter of self-evident, but yet very, very important. And then, of course, the recipients, the churches in Galatia. And then salutation of some sort. And here you have common Christian salutation, grace and peace. And by the way, these are the three ingredients that you find in non-biblical literature as well, in the prescript. Now, sometimes the prescript is pulled apart and other things are added. And you have some of that here. In which case, you get either into more preparation or perhaps into other relationships with regard to the prescript. But at least, basically, you have preparation and then the rest, and this includes both the body and the poster are realization with regard to the preparation and the prescript. So it's 1-5 in relation to 1-6 following that we're indicating here. Questions, comments?
Yeah, I was wondering, could we put 1-6-9 as, 1-6-9 as introductory remarks and put that together with the prescripts? Or does that necessarily, should that necessarily be divided and be a part of the body?
Well, that, always when you make a break at a certain juncture, what you're really doing is two things. One, asking yourself, what materials have common elements that recur? And I pointed out here, all we're saying here is that the prescript is recurrently treated here and didn't come to 1-5. So that involves comparable elements, recurring elements. The other has to do with distinctions or breaks. Now, does this introduce, simply elaborate the prescript, or does it introduce the polemic? In this case, you're moving to something different. You're moving to the beginning of the body of the epistle, and not simply something which introduces the whole. So that's the kind of question you have to ask. By the way, you know, the RSV has made that distinction between them. Part of it also involves recognizing what is usually in a prescript, and you have these three elements in 1-5. And there comes a natural break after the salutation. And part of it also has to do with how 1-10 following, especially 1-11 following, are related to 1-6-9. And if those verses substantiate, as they seem to do, 1-6-9, then those materials are bound together very closely. And he's, though he's including certain things he said already, as he would do, as it refers to the whole, this doesn't substantiate, for example, that there ought to be grace and peace to the churches in Galatia, that kind of thing. It doesn't substantiate the prescript, which, as I say, is made up of each essential component. It substantiates something you said in 1-6-9. So those are the two criteria you need to apply. And I've given you some of the others that might be cited in favor of the other, and we could give the same kind of thing in favor of the possibility of extending this to 1-9, or even 1-10. And that's the kind of thinking one has to do about this. Okay? Now, let's look at that prescript and ask ourselves if there's something else there besides just simple preparation and realization. Is there anything else there?
Well,
there's
kind of hints
towards
the limited unit.
I mean,
dropping things in the title.
All right, and those hints would involve what structurally? How would they relate in terms of construction here to what follows?
Definition of the character involved. I mean, he's giving a presentation of who he is, so I guess, the explanation of what's involved here, character.
All right, you have a description of the writer, the character of the writer, certainly the description of the writer, in terms of its contrast, not from men. And by the way, that probably involves human origin or human source, nor true man, even a human agent with regard to a divine source. And bring some interpretation now as a possibility here without going into the evidence. But, contrast, true, this is the agent and the element source, true Jesus Christ and God the Father. The question has to do with one of his apostleship and the source and agency of the apostleship. By the way, contrasting these two possibilities. And by the way, having said God the Father, he talks about the resurrection, which is very interesting. Of course, you have to ask the question, why does he bring up the resurrection at this stage? You know, all kinds of things you could say about God the Father. What he focuses on is the resurrection from the dead, Christ from the dead. And then he adds that there are others who join me, there are cohorts who write with me, really, although of course he uses I, which means he's doing the writing, and he says in the postscript here, in 6-11 following, 11-18, that he's written this with his own hand in large letters. So you have that element, and then you have the extension of the salutation, because the basic salutation would be grace to you and peace from God the Father and our Lord Jesus Christ. Then he adds, who gave himself, describing the Lord Christ, who gave himself for our sins to live, to deliver us from the present evil age according to the will of God, of our God and Father. Then he adds the benediction, to whom be glory forever and ever. So he's adding some other things here besides the just the usual salutation. The question is, how is that related structurally to what follows? Now let's come back to you, Tom. What are possibilities structurally here?
Foreshadow.
All right, and foreshadowing in a sense would be simply preparation and realization. Is this preparation and realization done in a more specific way? And that preparation and realization. That's the question you have to ask. Now, let me suggest a possibility, and our time is running out, otherwise we'll lose you more. But there is a possibility of particularization. He speaks in general certain ideas that he's going to develop in the epistle. Certainly one of these ideas has to do with the source and agency of his apostleship. As you know, he takes that up with the vengeance in 1:11 through chapter 2. And indeed, carries on with that question chapter 4. So he's making a general statement, perhaps, here about his apostolic office and the basis of it, which prepares you for the particulars which follow. Now, that's another element that may be involved here, along with what he says there in the salutation, to call attention to, and even what he says at the end of verse 1, the resurrection of Christ, indicating the general importance of that, and then the atoning work of Christ, and the matter of deliverance, victory from the present age. And one wonders if this present age does involve the kinds of things he's talking about here. The question is the age according to the flesh, or against the new age according to the Spirit. So there's a possibility of particularization or preparation, preparation, realization, by some particularization. The second is more problematic than the first. The first is pretty clearly involved in the Christian, but in the Testament. Any questions on what we've said there? You see how I was trying to get at the possibility to have another dimension to the preparation, which sort of reinforces it.
How about instantiation? I'm impossible because of this and that.
Yes, always, well, this is not always the purpose of it. Always particularization is essential. In other words, the particulars support the general statement. So that's involved here, necessarily. Sometimes I say that's not the main purpose of particularization, but I don't know any cases where the particulars don't support the general statement. So that's implied in the particularization. All right, questions now. Let's look at some of the questions that could be asked. We'll use some overheads here to get at the questions. What's the meaning of each component of the preparatory statement? And we've gotten into some of those meanings. We haven't gotten into all of them. For example, what's involved in apostleship? Very key element here in this epistle, as it is in other epistles, particularly here. How does each of these prepare for what follows? That's the modal question, modal form of the definitive question that you have to ask with regard to preparation and realization. How do the statements of 1-6 following realize the preparatory statement? Now, if it's general, you might add the general preparatory statements. We'll have copies of these, so. Do this only to reinforce what we're saying. Why are these preparatory statements made? We might add the other question about particularization. Why in the form of general statements, which are later particularized? Now we've gone through the definitive and the rational question. We come now to the implication question. What are the full implications of the answer to these questions? Those basic questions, I say those, the ones that relate to preparation and limitation, those are the basic kinds of questions you ask about prescripts. Always. And I would urge you to at least note the relationship when you look at other epistles so you make a decision about its presence and be aware of its presence. and the questions are not difficult to ask, particularly asking about straight preparation realization, following the sequence of these outlines. Any questions on these questions? Basic elements we have, the sequence we have, so yes.
Meaning of elementary group,
what does it involve? Another way of asking the same kind of question. How would you define? What's the definition of these things? I would not use significance. Significance is a very broad kind of term. So I would stay away from that. But there, I would use either dictionary and or Rodale synonyms to find other words, synonymous words to use, which might be clear to you, if meaning is unclear. In order to see relationships, you have to know what is meant by the things that are being related to each other. When you ask about how to get the meaning of the relationship between X and Y, you have to begin by asking what's the meaning of X, what's the meaning of Y, and then what is the meaning of the relationship between them. That's basically what we're doing here. And that's always the way you have to begin to structure questions. Otherwise, when you ask about the relationship, you have nothing as a basis for answering the question unless you know what the two things mean or relate. That's true of all relationships. Finding a separation of relationships is true of all relationships.
Asking questions about a complex relationship with the primary and secondary, how do you like to do it? You like to start by asking about the primary and then ask the definitive about the secondary, and then ask the rational about the primary, and then ask the rational about the secondary. There are implications about all of the above.
There are various ways of doing it. So I would hesitate to outline a specific sequence in a rigid way. But generally, I would begin with the primary law, as we did here, and then introduce any other elements that are supportive, auxiliary, or secondary, later on in the process. Now, we'll come to a law here that involves recurrence. Let me just indicate now one that we have down here already, which we talked about the last time, and that is within the body itself, which of course dominates most of the material of the book. So the way in which the body is structured is obviously primary for the book as a whole. But the criteria for primacy as to the amount of material is that the law controls all or most of the material of the book. The law that controls 1/6 through 6/10 would be this law of causation that we talked about. Remember that when we talked about the therefore? Now, I'll come back to the other in just a moment. Let's pick this up, the questions up that need to be asked here about the causation. And by the way, I would add to this causation that I suggested last time, the recurrence of causation and substantiation in the hortatory pattern, and the pattern of exhortation in 5:1 to 6:10. So you have exhortations either preceded or followed by a reason. They occur now in the hortatory pattern. We'll talk about that again. Very clear for our purposes. But this is really simply doing more of the same thing with regard to this causation between the telemetry unit and the hortatory unit. So I would ask questions about both of those. And so I would proceed along these lines. What's involved, what's meant by, in the causal statements of 1:6 to 4:31, relating to Paul's history, the Galatians' history, and scriptural history, and when we broke that down and material down in this fashion. If you didn't see that, find the paper and ask about the materials here, or if you broke it down autobiographical, doctrinal, these ways. What you have here is really the emphasis on history. You have the emphasis here in the biographical material, Paul's history. He refers to his own experience. Then you have here in 3:1 to 5, the Galatians history, and then primarily scriptural history. With three elements of scriptural history, Abraham, the law, and Christ, which are raised here. So we've simply highlighted those elements Why are these causal elements used? Well, once you get their meaning, then you ask, why are they used? Especially with regard to this element of causation we'll come to in just a moment. What are the exhortations of 5.1 following, and what does each mean? How are they the result of what precedes? The moment you say what precedes causes or produces these exhortations in 5.1 following, then you have to ask, how are these exhortations the result of what precedes? Or you could ask the question the other way around, how does what precedes produce the exhortations? And then we can add in this recurrence of causation and substantiation. By the way, we ask the question both ways, how are they the result of what precedes? How are they further substantiated in 5.1 following? That shows this element in. And then why are these exhortations made? That gets behind the problem which is addressed by the exhortations. And by the way, the reason why we said, I think it was the last time, that you, when you look for implicit relationships, particularly with regard to interrogation, you have to make sure that you have explicit materials which are being related by this implicit relationship, particularly by saying you have interrogation, is that otherwise you find interrogation everywhere. Not to be distinctive, because there are always needs to which a book is addressed. So we're not talking about interrogation, but we're getting at what's implied by these exhortations in terms of the need. Why are these exhortations made? Why are they substantiated as they are throughout the book? And then what are the implications for the answer to these questions? Now you can ask another set of questions which we'll use later on. We have enough here to get before you. We don't want to throw these in, complicate the matter. The moment you have a number of elements, not a single cause, but a number of causal elements, and a number of elements involving effects or results, and then you ought to relate them to each other and ask if there are any recurring elements within these causes, or within these results, within these exhortations. And so, how are they related to each other, and why are these relationships exist? That's what we have down here in brackets, and what are the implications of these relationships. Now, you see that if you were to answer these questions, you'd have the essence of the body of existence. There's nothing that really escapes this, these questions. And that's a good test as to whether you've gotten one, a primary law that relates materials to each other, and secondly, whether you've asked the right questions, whether they're comprehensive enough, conclusive enough. And I think you could see how this, none of those good these questions like that. All right, by the way, I have this overhead that I used the other day with regard to the hortatory pattern, which I put on reserve with these materials so you can copy it. If you didn't copy it from the board, this indicates four possibilities with regard to the hortatory pattern. We won't take the time to go over that, unless you have any questions about it. Unless your questions arose when we discussed it in class, or as we discussed it now in connection with causation. Okay. Now let's come to the law that we were talking about here a while ago. Let me ask you, what other primary laws did you find as volunteers on this, as you looked at the book as a whole?
I don't know if it was primary or secondary, but there's a constant recurrence of contrasting, always comparing and contrasting something to another over and over.
All right, we'll ask you about specifics in just a moment. Let me talk about the test of primacy, whether it's primary or secondary. The test of primacy is essentially this. If you have contrasts which subsume the entire book, so I don't mean in terms of one part of the book involving one side of it, another side involving the other side. Not necessarily that. But if your contrast subsumes the whole book, so the moment you put down the contrast, and you indicate a recurrence, you put down the contrast, X, whatever else, versus Y, and you have everything that covers everything, then you have a primary law. On the other hand, if you pick up incidental contrasts, and those could arise in all kinds of ways in this type of literature. And they don't subsume the entire material. Then you have something secondary. Now, I take it you're saying you're not sure, maybe.
Well, I think it's, that it would be primary because it would be continuity. There are similar words and ideas that are contrasted with other similar words and ideas throughout the whole book.
Okay, give us some specifics now from the church.
Under one category, there might be law, works of the law, curse, bondage, slavery, circumcision, and slave, as over and against, faith, freedom, free, promise, sons, and heirs.
All right.
And
very
some
good.
Of those elements are used repetitively.
Yeah.
So there's continuity and repetition.
Some are more dominant than others. But you've gotten hold of some very essential elements. Let me put some up here, and I haven't put them in two columns, which you could use also. But the human gospel versus the divine gospel, that's what the entire epistle is about. That's, of course, introduced by the priesthood. From the new gospel being the divine gospel, so we have the human gospel of the Judaizers. Circumcision versus uncircumcision, to which he comes back even in the postscript. We'll come to that here shortly. This, and I put an asterisk here because this gets to the very heart of the whole epistle, justification by works of law, or against justification by faith. Under law versus sons of God in Christ, slaves versus sons, which you've affected in your list, and this one is closely related to it, slavery versus freedom, but goes beyond the previous one, gets into what you have in the first part of 5 as well, and then what you have emphasized in 5, namely walking by the flesh versus walking by the spirit. Incidentally, when you ask, why does he introduce this whole matter of walking by the flesh here? Over against the spirit. Obviously, that's connected with justification by faith is over against justification by works of the law. If you're justified by works of the law, you're walking after the flesh. Justified by faith, you're walking after the spirit. In fact, that's what he indicates in the Galatians history in 3:1-5 as well. So these. I would say that these pass the test with regard to whether they cover what the entire book is about. Okay. Verb against more cursory, incidental, almost accidental contrasts that tend to be used recurrently in any ideological material. Okay, are we clear on this? So that's very good. I mean, very good. That's we've gotten very significant element. Now, let's go back to what I had in mind, Dana, when I began to respond to you. In a case of recurrence with something, I would begin with that which is done recurringly first and then ask about the recurrence of it. Otherwise, you're talking about recurrence in the abstract. So here I would begin with a contrast. And again, you have to ask what is meant by each of the elements involved in these contrasts. The elements that we've mentioned. And by the way, one of the reasons why it's a good idea to put your questions immediately after you've listed the law and the specific materials is that you can use pronouns like this to refer back to these materials is over against having to repeat each of these in the question. What's the difference between this human gospel and this? What's meant by the human gospel? What's meant by the divine gospel? What's meant by justification by faith? Is over against works of the law, etc., etc. So you get very detailed if you ask about each of those individually here. You can simply use a demonstrative pronoun and say what is meant by each of the elements involved in these contrasts. That's your X and your Y. Then you ask the question about the relationship. What are the differences between these contrasting elements? Especially, what are the differences between being justified by faith as over against works of the law? That's really the main contrast here, which everything else the book has for us. Why is there a recurring use of contrast. Now there you bring in the recurrence. By the way, here are the relational questions. What is relationship? What are the relationships between these contrasts? What does each mean? Is one of these a key contrast which includes all others? If so, which is it? And what does it involve? This relationship exists. Why is it used? Answer the question up here. And then what are the implications of the answers to these questions? This, of course, is case question has to do with all of these preceding ones. But these other questions are in brackets because they involve relationships between recurring elements. So, because there is a possibility when you have recurrence of contrast, let's use the letters of the alphabet here, to illustrate. A is over against B, C is over against D, E is over against F, etc. You may have various relationships between these. It's good to ask the question, how are these recurrence contrasts related to each other? And I have in mind more than a broad statement, they all involve the same thing. They're getting more precisely into relationships. For example, it may be that this whole business of emphasizing circumcision has to do with a humanistic kind of justification. The moment you emphasize the humanistic kind of justification by works, by what you do, then circumcision, that's right, takes on a very significant role because that's one of the things you can do. That is a work of the flesh. I'm getting into some possibility of the meaning of the flesh, and here you have to beware when you're moving into that area, but let me just indicate now this, and I'm really indicating answers to some of these questions about relationships. One of the elements of flesh has to do with acts of humans. And so it has to do with this humanistic kind of self-justification by their own acts, one of which is this light. It may well be that that is a very significant connection here that binds these elements together. And you might not see that connection if you simply see these as five or six distinct contrasts, you see. You can find out what the contrasts are between the elements within each contrast, but not see how they're related to each other. So this matter of relationships between recurring elements, if you have recurring elements, let's put that down here, recurring contrast, and gives you some insights that you might miss otherwise. So you have recurrence of contrast here. Any questions about this matter of either how you decide which contrasts are primary, which are secondary, or about this matter of asking questions about relationships between the recurring elements, as well as the meaning of each individual?
Any recurrence of contrast out there with visual effects and should be focused on the one you are asking?
26th. Now, let me give you some dates of a lesson, Fulton Keaton. Lessons that will give you some chance to look ahead if you'd like. Lesson 4 is a two-session lesson due on Tuesday, the 1st of October. If you miss any of these, raise your hand, please, so we don't need to go over them again. Lesson 5 will be a one-session lesson on the synthesis of Galatians. So it needs to be very much a synthesis. Condensed. Lesson 6, a two-session lesson. Thursday the 3rd. Lesson 6, a two-session lesson due on Tuesday the 8th. Tuesday the Ephesians. Lesson 7, a two-session lesson due on Friday the 11th, October. Lesson 8, a two-session lesson will be due on Thursday the 17th of October, and that will be a group lesson. We'll have several group lessons, and I'll talk with you about setting up the groups. Last one is Lesson 8, two sessions due on Thursday the 17th of October. And then Lesson 9, two sessions due on Tuesday 10/22. And Lesson 10, a two-session lesson due on Friday 10/25. That takes us through Ephesians. Okay? Lesson 6 is a two-session lesson. Due on 10/18.
Lesson 7 is also
Lesson 7 also two-session. We're only one section left in that group on the synthesis of Galatians, Lesson 5. Any other questions? Yes.
Lesson
4 is two sections. Through Tuesday 10/1.
What day is the 7th lesson on?
Lesson 7 is due on Friday 10/11. Any other questions? All right. Let's wind up very quickly what we were doing by way of surveying Galatians as a whole. And I do this not only from the standpoint of Galatians itself, but from the standpoint the other books we'll be studying, and preparing you to study any books at all. Let me put before you these strategic areas that we were talking about, all related to primary laws, either directly or indirectly. And I think we had before you this this overhead indicating the laws involved and the particular areas we selected. You could take the time to look at those areas, but unless what we've got down is not self-evident, we'll assume that either you have what's in mind before you already or can refer to it and get what we have in mind with regard to the elements of causation and the occurrence of contrast. The ones that I didn't put my hands on the last time or were under my nose, right under the folder, are the following, 323 to 29. I have the verses that suggest the contrast. Under law versus sons of God in Christ. 431, which is the very end of chapter 4, and then 5:1, which captures the connection between the two. By the way, that captures causation as well as contrast, slavery versus freedom. And then 5:13 to 16, the improper versus the proper use of freedom involving flesh versus spirit. So those, I would say, are strategic areas through which one could view the book as a whole, all related to the primary laws that we talked about. Now, any questions, pardon me?
Could you pass the overhead orders for A and B?
All right.
We're explaining that the strategic areas are always related to primary laws, either directly. So at the moment you have the law, you have the area, or indirectly, in which case you have to look for representative areas.
And these are referendum areas that I've listed here and on the sheet that I wrote and I just removed. We indicated the possibility of probability, but we didn't make a final determination. But we did have that, that's here, if indeed it is, it is present here. Either a summarization or a general statement, which would mean generalization. Okay? Now you could, through any of these areas, get at the book as a whole. See how they get at the essence of what you have in Galatians. And that, of course, is the first. The questions now about strategic areas as such, what we're looking for in these particular collections. Now let me talk very briefly about two other matters which we won't work with in connection with the overhead. One is historical information or higher critical data, and there are many things that could be learned from the book itself, and this is where you would focus at this stage, and on an observational basis concerning the author, obviously the parts to be written by Paul, and that's why we can say at this stage, unless until you make a judgment which ought to come later on, he claims apostleship, apostolic office, he's been to the churches in Galatia and preached to them, etc., etc. He can make many, many statements with regard to the writer of the epistle. Based on the observation of the data here. Data as to recipients. First, what you have is the churches of Galatia. Galatia is not pinpointed as to its geographical location or its character. That's a problem you have to deal with later on in the study process. When you get to the answer stage, and you can get into necessary data, both biblical and extra-biblical. And then you can learn all kinds of things about these people, obviously. They're engaged in this struggle with those who want to distort the faith, etc. So you know some of the problems they're having. By the way, that indicates also the occasion for the epistle. And you have some indications of the date of the epistle and perhaps also the place of the writing of the epistle. Certainly it would have to take, have been written after he visited these churches of Galatia, which, by the way, has a bearing on where those churches are. As you know, this gets beyond the observation level. The great debate has been as to whether Galatia refers to northern Galatia, which has to do with an ethnic Galatia, the place where the Gauls live, or the political Galatia, the province of Galatia, which is southern Galatia. And whether Paul visited northern Galatia at a certain time and how that time would relate to these events, including what happens in the events he records in chapters 1 and 2, would be one of the issues you could raise later on when you're trying to finalize your findings. Let me emphasize that one does not try to come to conclusions at this stage. One simply begins the process of collecting internal evidence. And as you know, there are two kinds of evidence that bear on historical criticism or information. One is internal, that's the kind of evidence you're getting at here. The other is external, which is extra-biblical, and it ought to await a later stage of the process. Indeed, I would not go outside the bounds of the book you're looking at, even biblically, as you need to do here to get all the biblical evidence that would have a bearing on some of these issues. So that's the kind of thing we have in mind by number 5 on your step-by-step description, what we call higher critical data information, historical data. The history of the writing of the book is what amounts to. Any questions on that? I would do some of that just to get used to it. But that's not as critical as some of these other areas that we deal with, particularly the first four areas, material structure questions, structural questions that is, and strategic areas, the four ones that we'll focus on the most. And then the other is the other major impressions, that sixth one on your step-by-step description, which is a catch-all category in which you place findings relating to the book as a whole that don't appear in these other categories, such as literary features, atmosphere, etc. These matters ought to involve the book as a whole, not details. And of course, they ought to be observational in character and not interpretive. For example, one finds that the atmosphere, the tone of this epistle, is rather harsh or severe, as Paul's epistle itself. There is very little, if any, commendation of the Galatians, which, by the way, is quite different from the other epistles we'll look at. And of course, his attack on the disorders is rather vicious. In fact, it tells me, I hope you mutilate yourself in chapter 5. It's a pretty strong statement. No question, but Paul is very, very disturbed by what's happening in Galatia. And that comes through in this epistle, quite contrary to the other epistles, which contain, in some cases, some of these elements have to do with heresies, but which don't involve this kind of tone, at least throughout, as this one does. So that's the kind of thing you would put under other major impressions. You don't look for things that belong in that category, but if you see them in the process of observing other things, and they don't fit in the other categories, then you simply put them into this catch-all category. Any questions on these six phases of the survey of the book as a whole? All right, if you have no further questions there, we'll turn our attention now to the first part on which we'll focus, namely 1:6 through chapter 2. Let me explain in terms of our procedure in class. If we had the time, and I wish we did, we would begin with a survey of each of these units. But we simply don't have that kind of time. If we did that, we would have very little time for analysis. Either that or it would be very limited as the passages we cover. So we're going to need to do some compromising here. But in the process of doing analysis, although sometimes we'll do the survey, in the process of doing analysis, we'll try to point up some of the major relationships that are involved in the unit as a whole. So in that way, we'll try to give you some data against which you can check your own findings, but we'll not try to begin, as a matter of course, with a survey of the unit as a whole. Let's begin now with the paragraph 1:6-9, and let's begin illustrating the process of analysis, which we talked about last time, therefore try to get at the various components of that statement and what the essence of each is, and try to get a label that captures that essence, and that includes, by the way, seeing relationships between these components in the process. Let me begin this for you to illustrate something of what we have in mind, and this is only one form of analysis. This doesn't necessarily indicate every form of analysis that can be used. But note that 1:6-9 are fundamentally I statements. They are statements about Paul. Not primarily statements about either the Galatians or the distorters, the perverters, the troublers. He begins with the assertion. Here, let me indicate analysis. By the way, one of the two components here is the emphasis on his amazement or astonishment. Thaumazo is the word he uses, the word that's used in the New Testament to indicate reactions to miracles. So you can get the gist of what he's saying. I am absolutely astonished. I simply cannot understand what's going on in the Galatian church. And he makes the assertion, we could label this fact the assertion, this assertion of his astonishment. And now what he does is to move to the reasons why he is astonished or utterly surprised by what's going on. Now, by the way, that relationship is implicit because what he goes on to do is to describe the Galatian church, that you are so quickly deserting, etc. But what he's really indicating is that not only what he's astonished about, but why he's astonished. Now, incidentally, when the more you study Paul, the more you realize that Paul structures his statements in a variety of ways. And very often, the structure involves implicit relationships, which you have to infer from what otherwise have to do with other kinds of grammatical instruction structure besides the usual substantiatory structure. You see, he could have said, I am astonished because. That's substantiation, isn't it? But what he does is go on to describe them, which indicates the reasons for his astonishment. Now, I've broken those reasons down into the following elements. First of all, the fact of this desertion or revolt, and by the way, again, the language is very, very strong. It's a language used in a literal sense for those who revolt militarily or politically. So he's talking about turncoats, disloyal rebels. On the surface, it means that's changing one's opinion, but it's a lot stronger than that in this case. He's talking about those who are revolting against what he proclaimed. So he's describing them in a pretty strong way by the use of this term. So this fact of desertion and revolt, the time of the desertion, or it could be the manner, namely, you are so quickly deserting. Not merely that you are deserting, but so quickly. Now, if he's emphasizing the time of the desertion, so how soon it's happening, you have to ask, of course, how soon after what? How soon after Paul proclaimed the gospel in the Galatian churches, or soon after these troublers and perverters came into these churches and tried to influence them? We don't know the answers to those questions, but those are questions you need to raise. It could include the element of the manner of desertion, that is to say, they did so readily, without really thinking it through. And by the way, we'll come to 3:1, where he uses the word foolish, which really means, literally, mindless. Without really using your mind, without thinking it through. So it may involve also the manner of their desertion, that they did it so easily and readily, without wrestling with the issues involved and the implications involved about desertion. And then thirdly, the object of their desertion and the results of their desertion, what is it they deserted? Note, he doesn't say you deserted certain ideas or certain doctrines certain commitments that you made to me. Deserting, note the three elements here. Him who called you, and of course that refers to whom?
God.
God refers to God the Father, him who called you. And of course the calling is a personal summons which you receive from the God of the universe. And by name he said, I want you to be a member of my church and my family and my elect. And then the in the grace of Christ indicates what kind of relationship? Yes, the means by which he called them, and it's a gracious means. God has given you the unmerited favor. You didn't deserve it. God called you by name, asked you to join his family and his church, and he did this in and through Christ. That grace, that unmerited favor, is expressed in relation to what Christ has done, and by the way, that's what he is pointing to in the prescript in 1:1-5. The role of Christ in this whole process. You are deserting divine persons. That's what you're doing. And that's the ultimate sin, isn't it? Not that they deviate from some kind of doctrinal standard or some kind of ideas or some kind of commitment to human beings. They are deserting God and Christ and grace. That's the act of ultimate seriousness. And the result of their desertion is that they are turning to a different gospel, a different version of the gospel, is what that really means. In fact, this the first Greek exegetical study I did in seminary was on these verses here in terms of a heteros and a los. A different version of the gospel, that is not another gospel. That's a very clear-cut distinction. A different version of the gospel, which, however, is not really good news. And by the way, one of the main issues raised in this entire book is a very contemporary issue, and that is the issue of the human perversion of the gospel that turns it into something other than good news. Indeed, whatever human beings do, by way of adjusting the gospel, whether it be by legalism, whether it be by success theology, whether it be by any other version or means, whatever is done to distort the gospel ends up being bad news. Cannot be good news. Good news can come only from God. And what we'll find in this entire epistle is that there is a great danger that we as human beings will take the gospel of God in Christ and begin playing with it and end up with something that is a different version, but not good news. And that's what he's talking about in this this case. And then he points to the agents of this desertion, and he calls these agents troublers and perverters. We could have talked about the inflections here, the use of the present tense in several of these cases. It's used here in the form of a present participle. And that is, those literally who shake you like back and forth like this, that is to say, who disturb, upset, unsettle, harass you. And of course, that means that their actions don't have as their purpose the well-being of the people, but rather they are unloving, uncaring individuals who simply are trying to upset these people. That's their character and their activity. And their purpose and intent is the desire to pervert, to distort, to turn about, to change from one thing to its opposite, the gospel, which was proclaimed to them, that is to say, the gospel of Christ. So it's because of these elements, give me support now, these elements, that he expresses this astonishment at what's going on in the Galatian church. Now, let me emphasize how we got at this point. We got at this point, beginning with the question we asked you in the syllabus, lesson 3 under analysis, lesson 2 under analysis, what reasons are given, that indicates substantiation, in 1.6b to 7 for the astonishment expressed in 1.6a. Now you see, in order to answer that question, you have to go back and observe the text, right? Detailed observation of the text, including detailed analysis of the text, which is observational, but also, and you see I've gotten into it, interpretation. So you see how the process runs, as we outlined at the beginning of the course. What you do is simply backtrack in answering these questions and do observation, detailed observation, both at the observational level and interpretive level. And in that process, by the way, you ask questions. You see, what's meant by so quickly? Is he emphasizing time? Is he emphasizing manner? What's meant by deserting? What's meant by troubling, etc.? See, I've been answering those questions. You see the process by which we did this? This there's no injustice done to induction here. What we're simply doing is reversing the process for the sake of expediency in order to be able to move more quickly and with a purpose. And you see how we've done analysis here? We've broken this down into its various components. We've tried to get the essence of each, and we've tried to put a label on these. In some cases, you have grammatical labels. In some cases, you have structural labels. Agents, of course, is a structural label. That's instrumentation, isn't it? And then sometimes you have a logical label. For example, the time of the desertion. That's a logical label. Of course, it's connected with grammar, but that's a logical label. Okay, any questions here on what we've said, how we've set this up, and how we did it? Okay, we come now to the second emphasis that you have here, and that is the emphasis on his condemnation. That's the other dimension here. He pronounces a curse, an anathema, on these perverters and all like them. And by the way, this relates to number 2, what is emphasized in connection with the anathemas of 1.8 to 9. And here again, you see the forcefulness of Paul's statements. I don't think Paul would say, let certain people be damned. And we don't use contemporary terminology, but it's close to that terminology, unless he felt pretty strongly about this, unless they deserved it. Now, let's note the emphases, the objects of the condemnation, and you note that the emphasis there is not on, is really on the who, but in relation to the gospel, a gospel contrary to what we preach to you. Say that the standard is the gospel proclaimed by Paul to the Galatian churches. That is the criterion. against which this anathema is to be pronounced. And note, he says, that who does this kind of preaching of a gospel contrary to what we preach to you doesn't really make any difference. Even if we, include himself, if we came back to you and preached a different version of the gospel from that original gospel, we ought to be under curse. We ought to be damned. Or even if an angel from heaven, in other words, the messengers make no difference. See, the essential issue is the message. Does it comply with the gospel I originally preached to you and which you received, you later go down to say? So that's the criterion. That's the litmus test. That's the basis on which you make a judgment as to who ought to be cursed. Now, you see, there's no personality cult involved. It isn't who it is, it's what is being proclaimed and how it relates to that original gospel. So the objects are anyone, especially here, he goes on just to generalize in just a moment, you should see, but especially we, those with me, I, those with me, or even angels from heaven. That's not the issue. The basis, the reason for the condemnation is that the original gospel which was proclaimed and received is the true gospel. Therefore, no matter who it is that proclaims otherwise, is to be condemned and cursed. And then the expression of the condemnation, which you have recurrently, he says it twice, you have recurrence therefore, with generalization. Note, he goes on to add then, just for good measure, in verse 9, as we have said before, so now I say again, and by the way, the question you have to ask is, said before where? Is he alluding to what he has just said in the epistle, or as to what he said to them verbally? We're not sure. But in any case, now he generalizes. If anyone, not only those included in the we, or not only an angel from heaven, but if anyone, this is all inclusive. You see how it generalizes? Moving from particular ones to a general statement. If anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to that which you receive, which we preach, and which you acknowledge, an experience of the true gospel, let him be cursed. So what you have really are two reactions of Paul. His astonishment and his condemnation in 1:6-9, with other factors involved, primarily the reasons for these reactions. That's the primary element, but you have other weakness as well. Any questions on this? You see how we're doing analysis? We're taking these things apart, looking at the components, asking what their essence is, and then trying to put a label on them to indicate the essence, that essence. And then, of course, in the process, seeing relationships between them. And that is what analysis is all about. This is one form of it. Questions, comments, yes?
Question. Is this what our lesson should look like?
I hesitate to lock you into a particular format, way of doing things, but this is the kind of thing you ought to be getting at. And I would urge you, one, to do analysis, and two, to list whenever possible, as over against using the essay form. In the essay form, as you know, you tend to ramble, you tend to pad. Now here, where you list, you indicate distinct and separate ideas. That economizes on time as well as helps develop skills with regard to making distinctions and expressing those distinctions, etc. So I would move toward this kind of thing, although I wouldn't lock you into this precise putting of the elements. Any other questions? Now, we're going to move on to 1:10 following, and there we have to ask, what does he begin doing in 1:10, and how is that related to what proceeds in 1:6-9? Let me ask you, what note he uses recurring interrogation, although the last part of the statement is an assertion. What is Paul doing in 1:10? Let's have some volunteers on that. Just on Mike.
It seems to be
and evidence in regard to what particular element?
Well,
What does he focus on?
Focusing on his apostleship as well as how he went out and learned apart from those who are already called apostles. So
all right. So you're thinking of 111 following also. I'm thinking now of 110. Just that one statement. Oh. Am I now seeking the favor of men or of God? Am I trying to please men, etc.? On what is he focusing with regard to himself? He is focusing on himself, isn't he? Right. What is the focus?
His desire is to please God above anyone.
Yeah. All right. His motivation. What am I trying to do? What motivates me in saying these things? And he spells out that motivation in a twofold way, which, by the way, gives us the clue, the key to what you have and what follows, the substantiation by contrast. And this is one of the main reasons why I would say you have substantiation, not interrogation here. Because Paul's astonishment is not the problem. Or his condemnation is not the problem. Now, in the process of expressing his astonishment and his condemnation, he does indicate what the problem is. Something is going on in Galatian churches, or just changing things. But the focus is on the I, and that's why he goes on to talk about himself instead of the you. Focus is on the I, beginning with this matter of motivation, and that carries through, as you say, in terms of these two units that we've indicated here. Now we've gotten the structure of the whole, you say. It's really the thesis expressed. That's what he's really doing. He is saying, in effect, the gospel I preach and which you receive is the true gospel, the authentic gospel. That which is being proclaimed by these troublers and perverters is the false gospel. That's the basic element behind the statement of 1:6-9. And, of course, he's astonished that they're moving away from the former toward the latter. And he pronounces curse on those who caused them to move toward the latter, this false gospel, you see? But really, he's putting himself on the spot. My gospel is the true gospel. The other gospel is the false gospel. That's the basis for his reaction, and that's the thing which he then addresses, as Mike has so well pointed out, in this substantiation by contrast, beginning with this matter of his motivation, his initial motivation. So this, I would say, is the structure essentially of the whole. A contrast in what amounts to the thesis, and we'll have another overhead in just a moment that expresses that more clearly, and then substantiation by contrast in the rest of these materials.
Could it be possible to, in verse 10, also see that when he uses the thing, am I now seeking the favor of men or of God, see possibility that he is answering a charge that has been leveled against him in the past?
Yes. As a matter of fact, he comes back to that in chapter 4, where he goes back to how he was accepted and received initially in 4:12 following, and what's going on now, and what seems to be behind the charge concerning what he's doing. So I think somewhere along the line the charge is being made. The reason why he proclaimed the gospel he did has to do with some kind of human motivation. His desire to please somebody, maybe Gentiles who don't want to do what they ought to be doing with regard to Jewish law, etc., or maybe certain other church leaders or what have you. So he's addressing a very real issue. Now, by the way, going back to that, let's use this other overhead now, where you have the thesis expressed in 1:6-9, and then what you have is Paul's self-vindication in 1:10 following, beginning with his motivation, or his character, that assumes that the likelihood is that if a person's motivation is wrong, then the gospel that person proclaims is wrong. That's the implication of this. In other words, it's authentic persons who are inclined to preach an authentic gospel, and inauthentic gospel is proclaimed often by inauthentic persons. And that's why in Paul, and indeed elsewhere in the New Testament, very often what you have is a focus not so much on doctrine as on the people who proclaim the doctrine. Because very often that's the touchstone as to how good the doctrine is. And so you see that he attacks these people. In fact, let's turn quickly to 4:12 following, where he says in we won't read the whole of it, but 4:16 following, have I then become your enemy by telling you the truth? They, he's saying himself over against they make much of you, but for no good purpose. They want to shut you out, that you may make much of them. This is all self-serving. They are serving, they're trying to please other human beings to aggrandize themselves. And by the way, what he's really doing is asking not only that they look at him, what kind of motivation does he have, but also look at the perverter, see what their motivation is, and compare and contrast the two to find out whose motivation is authentic. And he goes on to say, by the way, in 18 of chapter 4, for good purpose, it is always good to be made much of, not only when I am present with you, my little children, with whom I am again in travail until Christ be formed in you, I could wish to be present with you now and to change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. He goes on to indicate what his attitude toward them is. So these people are just trying to use you. They're men pleasers, not God pleasers. They're serving themselves, not servants of Christ. I'm quite the opposite. And therefore, I have a right to claim that what I'm proclaiming to you is the authentic gospel on this basis, as one basis. Now, not as the only basis. There are other bases as well that he moves to, but certainly this is one basis. I would urge us in the contemporary scene, particularly when you have so much of the personality cult, who's doing the preaching? And people are charismatic, I'm using that in the sense of being very magnetic people, appealing people, right? They really draw people. We have to ask ourselves, what kind of people are they? What's motivating them? What's making them tick? Is it their concern for human beings and for the gospel of God in Christ, or is it some other kind of concern? That's one reason why I think, by the way, that every evangelical, that ought to include you, go to the local church, wherever you go, and certainly ought to include the persons who are on the media, who get a lot of money, ought to have an independent audit to find out what's happening with the money. Are they using it to serve themselves, or are they using it for the sake of the kingdom? I'm saying this, making this as a neutral statement. I'm not saying so-and-so belongs in this category and so-and-so belongs in this category. But that's one thing I look for on the basis of this principle, that authentic people who are out to please God, not other human beings themselves, who are serving Christ in the gospel, those people are the ones to whom we ought to listen. We'll have an authentic kind of gospel. Well, we could say much more. I think you can take the matter from there and go on. Now, he moves to his source and mode of illumination, which I think Mike was getting at. And there he states his main point, which is really dominant in this material, in 1:11 following. And again, he sets it up by contrast, because he indicates that what has come to him by way of the gospel of what he calls the gospel of Christ, was not preached by him because it was man's gospel, man as the source. And then he supports that substantiation in verse 12. For I did not receive it from man, it did not have a divine origin, nor was I taught it by human beings. See, going back really to what he said in the prescript. So it has neither a human origin nor a human agency. But its source and its agent is divine. It came through a revelation of Jesus Christ. That is the key to Paul's thinking here. And it's for this reason, then, that he gets into this long autobiographical statement in which he uses his own history, his own experience, to support one or the other of these two elements or poles in this contrast. Some will be addressed to the negative. See that in just a moment. Some will be addressed to the positive element. So what he's doing is supporting one or the other of these in order to emphasize his main point, as to say, his gospel as a divine source and a divine agency behind it. And that's why it's the true gospel. Not because it happened to be the first one he preached. That's not what he's saying back in the preceding verses, but rather because he preached what he had received by this divine disclosure go against something which is humanly originated. And I say again that we have to be extremely aware of the human influence on what is called the gospel. Just because something is called the gospel, that doesn't make it the gospel. You can have the divine gospel, that's the true good news. But you can have a human and a humanized version of the gospel. And of course, this is good news. This is glad tidings. This seems to be good news, but is not good news. No need to add to it. And the reason for that is that, of course, God's good news is addressed to human beings because they have bad news. What comes to human beings is bad news. That's why you have to have a divine gospel that confronts them with the good news. And so this is the great contrast that he is trying to develop here. Now, that's for lack of time, let me take you through this again in terms of another form of analysis, where I take what the main points are he's making by way of supporting either, as I say, the negative, and label these negative or positive, either this negative part or this positive, and he begins by emphasizing something which supports the negative. It could not have been by human origin or by human teaching, because when you look at what I was before I became a Christian, on the basis of human influence and human teaching and human environment, you find that I was under Judaism, so zealous that I persecuted violently, viciously, the Church of Christ. And